This is Spectator Radio, and you're listening to Life and Arts with Dominic Green for Spectator USA.
Welcome to The Green Room, Spectator USA's weekly Life and Arts podcast. This week, we're broadcasting live from New Criterion's headquarters in Manhattan, a location specially chosen for the rattling of transportation outside, as if you're trapped in an Edward Hopper picture, which is nothing if not appropriate. As the old year staggers to a close, like a drunk at a Christmas party, and the new year is nearly upon us, like a mewling, puking babe. Who better to look back on the year in art, and to look forward for another year in art, with a team of critics on crack from the New Criterion? I'm sorry, I'll read that again. Team of crack critics from the New Criterion. With me, James Pinero, Benjamin Riley, and Andrew Shea. Welcome all to The Green Room.
Thank you, an honor.
It's great to be here.
Thanks, Dominic.
Well, it's very good of you to host me here. We were just trying to remember what had taken place in 2018 and looking back into the dim mists of time. The year began with some muscular heroics from Michelangelo, James.
Carmen Baumbach's Michelangelo Drawings exhibition at the Met, an incredible achievement. You've never seen so many drawings in one place. It made the case, to me, also that Michelangelo was primarily, in my opinion, a sculptor who made drawings, and he drew like a sculptor.
And how can you see this in the work?
I think of the way that he did hatch marks. So he kind of carved the paper as he would carve stone, doing these straight lines, and that created shadowing. I like to see more of it. It was a traditional, great traditional big Met show. I don't think we see enough of them these days.
Well, I mean, the big show of the spring, I think, was Delacroix at the Met as well.
Fall.
The fall. Was that the fall? It felt fall. Like the spring to
me. Opened in September.
Okay.
It was in the Louvre this spring.
It was. That's where I saw it.
Yeah, pretty right. Warm see, in September this year.
Yeah. It's all, my brains have gone to mush. Again, Delacroix. The greatest hits coming through there. Do you feel that, you know, the public likes the old and solid? And I know, of course, Delacroix was once an outrageous. Again, what was the highlights, would you say, of this one?
I think something to keep in mind is that both shows were very difficult to put on, given the just logistics of getting them together. The Michelangelo show, for instance, they had to stop at a certain point because the drawings are so fragile that they can only be exposed to light for a certain amount of time.
All the mouth breathers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and then the Delacroix show, given that so many of those paintings are so huge, and then they're all in France, it was very difficult for them to put it together. So really kudos to the Met for doing that.
Well, it's the sort of thing that the Met excels at and should do more of. Mm-hmm.
It has the muscle to put that kind of show together. I mean, just the insurance alone for a show like that's astounding.
It's a financial nightmare in addition to a logistical one.
What was great about that show for me was that we mainly see Delacroix in reproduction. I mean, he's so well known. Those paintings are so well known. And they're so large and they get reduced so small when we see them. And they look terrible in reproduction. When you see them in person, they're right on the surface. That was what was exciting about Delacroix. I wrote about it for you, was how the blood, the tears are right there on the surface, popping out of the surface of the picture.
Yeah. And you also, because of the scale of it, they showed you multiples, often sketches, different versions and so on, and you get a sense of process.
Yeah, way. Well, it made the case that he's a more serious artist than I think many of us may assume.
Now, James, you're notorious as going all over the place. Well, I say notorious. I mean, widely praised.
Infamous, the word.
For traveling far and wide, and far and wild, even, looking for new artists as well. What were there some highlights across the river in Brooklyn this year?
Gosh.
don't mean to spring it on.
I got to tell you, I probably spent more time in Venice than I did in Bushwick this past year.
I wanted
regrettably.
To see in Venice.
Well, I was there because the Tintoretto exhibition that's coming to the National Gallery opening March 10th is right now in Venice. If you go, I think in the next 2 weeks, you can still see it, depending on when you're listening to this podcast. I think it goes on until the beginning of January at the Palazzo Ducale. And there's also a young Tintoretto show at the Accademia. And, of course, there's Tintoretto in every scuola that's in Venice.
Nailed to the wall, unfortunately.
Yeah,
not going anywhere.
They're not going anywhere.
There's been a couple of trailer exhibitions, in a way. The Morgan
has some drawings.
Yeah.
There's also some portraits at the Lehman Wing of the Met.
There are the portraits of the Lehman Wing. He was a much better portrait painter than I think we may recognize. We all know him for these enormous paintings like Miracle of the Slave and incredible scenes like that, religious scenes. But actually, his portraits of his contemporaries in Venice are very moving, very true, very lifelike and remarkable. Those are now at the Met. There was also a drawing exhibition at the Morgan, which continues. Both the Met and the Morgan shows continue into the beginning of the new year. The Morgan drawing show is also going to the National Gallery and will open at the same time as the show now at the Place Ducale.
And are we expecting a shift in critical opinion about Tintoretto? Is there some new angle we're going to see on him in what is the first major show of his work in the United States?
I think we owe it to the curator, who's at MFA Boston, Fred Ilchman, and his colleague, who's an independent scholar, Bob Eccles, for really bringing Tintoretto back from maybe a little bit of a second fiddle to Titian, let's say. Mm-hmm. There was the exhibition in, it may have been almost 10 years ago at MFA Boston, Titian Tintoretto Veronese, which was really the first time that we had a chance to really consider Tintoretto recently in the United States. Before that, there was a Tintoretto exhibition at the Prado. And it was Fred Ilchman's idea with the 500th anniversary of Tintoretto's birth in 1518 to say, let's do something big for this great artist, probably the most Venetian of the Venetian painters. Mm-hmm. He was born in Venice, died in Venice, and his paintings are almost all in Venice. He wasn't selling to the Spanish crown the way Titian was.
Was it Ruskin that loved Tintoretto?
Yes,
that's Tintoretto. Probably why he's so unfashionable. Ruskin liked him.
And I think that affected his standing in that lots of stuff which from his workshop or merely associated in some way was being sold as Tintoretto.
At TFAF at the Armory this year, they had a Tintoretto ceiling of some provenance.
But the Ilchman catalog resume has clarified a lot of these questions in there. And I know in Venice, the exhibition had all sorts of interesting information about how you can justify including or excluding a particular work.
And also, Ilchman put out a new book, Tintoretto in Venice. I think it's through Save Venice. And it's a very helpful guide if you're in Venice, even after the Palazzo Ducale show is closed. It shows you all the places in Venice you can find a Tintoretto painting. And it really is every corner there's a Tintoretto if you just go inside.
Now, another painter who came up on the list here, there was a Chaim Soutine show at the Jewish Museum.
Right. That was, I think, over the maybe late spring, early summer. I think this is it because I wrote about it in June.
Right.
Okay. But he is a Russian-born painter who moved to France in the sort of early modern era. And his paintings were really ahead of his time because they were extremely expressionistic and very kind of wild and, you know, flinging paint everywhere. But in a lot of ways, too, he was also a very traditional painter. He was looking at people like Chardin, people like Rubens. Mm-hmm. And the painting, the exhibition that I saw was, or that a lot of people saw, was at the Jewish Museum. It was called Flesh. Chaim Soutine, and it was focused on still lives of his that were of dead animals.
Oh, okay. So very much in the Chardin line then.
Right, exactly. And so in a lot of ways, it was a very gruesome exhibition. There was, you know, half-plucked turkeys, decaying carcasses of beef. There was the one I really liked was a stingray that was kind of disemboweled. And so these were all still lives, but in a way, it kind of has this very gruesome effect, but they're really beautiful paintings, too.
There was an exhibition in London at almost the same time. It overlapped, which was of portraits. Now, see, it's all emerging.
That was at the Court Hall.
Yeah, the Court Hall had a tremendous show. And this was of chambermaids and bellhops.
Right.
Much like stingrays, really.
Well, yeah, the surface is certainly, you could see the same stuff. But so Soutine's star keeps rising and rising.
Yeah, I think it was a surprise to a lot of people because he's not really considered, you know, one of the greats of that era. There's so many great painters, you know, he was painting along with. But this exhibition, I think, really surprised some people in a very good way.
He had a tough time in Paris. You know, he was such a bohemian, so down and out.
Yeah.
I think he was living in La Ruche, the beehive with all the other artists. And he discovered an abscess on his ear. And it turned out to be a nest of bed bugs.
Oh.
That was life in Paris.
He died young, too, of an stomach ulcer during the Second World War.
Exactly.
What
I heard about Soutine that's tough is that so many of the paintings are in the Barnes Collection, and those paintings don't lend. So it's hard to do a Soutine show.
Exactly. Yeah, I'd say that's true.
I'm surprised in a way they didn't pool their resources. There were two shows on opposite sides of the Atlantic competing with each other. And if they'd combined what they had, they could have given a full picture of what he was capable of in a way.
Sure. Yeah, I think the exhibition at the Jewish Museum was actually, in a way, it was nice, though, because it was small enough that you could really go through it.
The bohemian life is catching up with you. The little bit of the TB.
And the
comeback.
The focus of being specifically these kind of dead animals was actually a nice way, and a nice way to focus the exhibition. Which was...
Now, from dead animals to living ones, we were talking about the auction houses.
We were.
Just now, then, and some astonishing reversals have occurred.
Amazing.
Cora's Women was a show. Cora's Women in Washington. But Cora himself?
Cora, yes. There was a Cora at Christie's yesterday that only went for around $12,000. Amazingly cheap for something like that. Meanwhile, in London, 2 weeks ago, the Annabelle sale, the famous Annabelle's moving next door, getting rid of their old fusty decor. A Munnings study for a horse in a stable block went for 10x its high estimate, £250,000, which must be cheering everyone who owns a Munnings right now.
I was going to say, it may be time to look in the attic and see if you have a dusty old picture of a racehorse in an expensive-looking frame. It could be a Munnings.
That could be a gold mine.
That's our auction tip for 2019.
So, yeah, as every editor says, is this a trend?
Probably not.
So, looking ahead into the fog of 2019, what are the trends? I noticed New York Magazine recently had on its cover a Salvador Dali impersonator.
Who was that, Andy? Did you recognize that guy?
Who he impersonated, or... Oh, sorry, whoops, I fucked that up.
We haven't told you about Salvador Dali
yet,
but
sorry.
We're going to break that news gently.
Yeah. We're going to have to...
Stop looking at your phone.
Can you get off your phone?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Critics on crack.
Yeah. Salvador Dali. He was formulating a hashtag.
The Salvador Dali impersonator who was on the cover of New York Magazine.
Oh, yes.
His name is Jerry Saltz.
Right. Yeah, the famous Jerry Saltz, a Pulitzer Prize winner, actually.
What for?
For talking about himself, I think.
Oh, okay.
Jerry Saltz is the critic for New York Magazine. He did win the Pulitzer Prize for writing an essay about why he's a failed artist. I wrote a piece for this magazine called My Jerry Saltz Problem, maybe 8 years ago, something like that, talking about how Jerry Saltz kind of trolls. He's a master of new media. And the use of new media as a critic and proximity to artists that maybe traditional criticism is a little wary of. He describes himself as a failed artist. I think in reality he's a failed critic, but a successful artist. And this whole game that he's playing is a kind of quote-unquote criticism. He's playing the critic.
It's a great performance.
It's a performance.
Oh, he's made himself into a work of art.
He's made himself into a work of art. And the way he fails as a critic is he's not honest about that fact. And you can see it, the cover of New York Magazine. He's dressing up as Frida Kahlo or as Salvador Dali. You can collect all three, by the way.
I think it might be an investment.
Yeah. But here he is. It's about Jerry. It's all about the Jerry show in the end.
Right. And this one he's writing about how to be an artist, which is kind of ironic considering he is a failed... I mean, well, okay.
He's a failed artist or a failed critic? I'm becoming confused.
He failed as a critic by saying
this is how you become an artist.
I think he succeeded as an artist by describing how he became a failed critic. I don't know. We're all confused now, aren't we?
it
made sense on paper.
Yeah. Talking of making sense on paper, one of the exhibitions I'm looking forward to this year is Toulouse-Lautrec at the Boston MFA.
They're going to do a big job in the gift shop on that.
That is. I can see the posters already.
Are you trying to pitch it? Do you want to write about it for us?
I was going to say, have you booked anyone for that? Because
we should talk.
Yeah. I think it starts in April. what are your feelings on Toulouse-Lautrec? I mean, is it popular, ever dependable? If you're going to open a French-style cafe, you'll be needing to book those posters.
Are you allowed to ask these days if his popularity has anything to do with the fact that he has an incredibly compelling personal history? Are you even allowed to ask those questions?
Yes, he did have a compelling personal history.
Short?
Short, quite short. I mean, dwarfish.
Yeah, it's a short history.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be a crowd pleaser, isn't it?
Yeah, come on. The freakish nightlife scenes of the bohemian earworm thing, like Soutine had.
Uh-huh.
This is what people want from
everyone's imagination of Montmartre.
Those posters are a lot bigger than you think.
Yes.
Because, we see them in reproduction, and they're about a quarter of the size.
They're not coaster-sized.
That's it.
Which is how I have them. But
Are they going to make special Bard College editions of
the posters? I'm sure they will doing a nice facsimile line in them. And they are beautifully done, even though, of course, you know, that they aren't perhaps his greatest work. That's the question really about this is. Now, what else is coming up this year? There is some all change going on in the back offices of some of America's leading museums.
Well, the news of the National Gallery, where the Tintoretto exhibitions are opening in March, is that Rusty Powell, director there for 25 years, is retired, and Cayman Feldman is the new director. It gives me some pause. That appointment, she is a very political and interventionist type director. And I think, whatever you think of those politics, the way you tend to succeed in culture in Washington is by remaining quite apolitical. And I wonder if she will step in it sooner than later. And we'll wait and see about that.
And of course, there was also a change at the top in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Very complicated pas de deux involving curators there.
Well, Tom Campbell was out, burned out for a few reasons. I think Tom Campbell came in, replaced Philippe de Montebello, wanted to be a bit of a change agent in the end, tried to do a lot of new media, web stuff, got into some personal problems, overspent, became an enemy of many curators. And was eventually...
It sounds like the life of Van Gogh or something.
He was there no more. And he'd been replaced by... Who was it, Andy?
In June 2017, they named Daniel Weiss the president.
That's right.
So they split the position up into two.
Oh, yes, right.
They made a president, and then there was going to be a director who they hadn't hired yet. But they more recently hired Max Hollein.
Well, they always had those two positions, but you're right. There was a change in that the president of the Met now is superior in rank to the director, whereas those were flipped for a time under De Montebello. And so you're right, Dan Weiss is really in charge, and Max is he's the director, but he's one step down. And meanwhile, Campbell has ended up on the left coast taking Max's old position. Bit of game of musical chairs. It doesn't really show a lot of imagination in the museum world, does it?
Well, that was my next question, is how would you rate the general health of the major museums? And also, how are the small galleries doing?
I always expect more now out of a place like the Morgan or the Frick. I think they're in a better position. They can be more focused. They don't have to be everything to everybody. I think the large museums feel a need to, you know, operate as both a museum, internet cafe, soup kitchen, and 10 other things. And it doesn't really produce the best curated shows. And
the Frick's been fantastic lately.
Fantastic.
The Van Eyck show, which I wrote about for you, Dom.
Yes, you did.
Had an exceptional feature, which I advise more museums to take up, which is to provide magnifying glasses.
For the older visitor. I find it invaluable.
For my tired eyes, allowing me to get close to those paintings was really brilliant. And the previous exhibition that was at the Frick, it was either last year or this year, they all run together. The Zurbaran, the Sons of Jacob, which have come to us from County Durham in England, are exceptional, from Auckland Castle. That was a real treat seeing all those costumes.
And they excel at those kind of micro shows where you get one little snapshot in beautiful detail with all the necessary supporting information around it. And they have a Tiepolo.
Well, I was gonna say, on the theme of musical chairs and museums, so now, as you, our listeners may remember, the Met Broyer, which used to be the Whitney Museum and is now being leased for 8 years by the Metropolitan, will be sublet by the Frick.
Oh, it's complicated, isn't
it? Very complicated, for the final 3 years, I believe. And the Frick will move in to Met Broyer, a.k.a. Old Whitney.
While the Frick is undergoing its
expansion. Is undergoing its expansion. And actually, some people are kind of interested in that fact. You never get to see these works in different settings.
Yeah.
They look amazing in the Frick, obviously. In the domestic interiors, they're quite packed in. Let's see what it looks like in the Broyer building.
Yeah, and you will see the works individually rather than in this kind of great collective staged performance in the period building.
Now, I will say they are moving out for a reason. I'm not totally behind. Now, I think Ian Wardropper, director of the Frick, is terrific. I think he does a great job. They attempted to do a renovation a couple years ago by removing what is essentially an empty lot that's next to them. And putting in new visitor services and a new entry there. People objected to this because there's a kind of 1970s postmodern garden that's there that some people love. In my opinion, it's not contextual to the streetscape. It was never meant to be a permanent thing. And unfortunately, what that meant is they went back to the drawing board, and now they're keeping the garden, but will destroy the music room.
Well, that's not a good exchange at all.
No, it really isn't.
And how about the small gallery scene? How is the capillary action of the art world going? Because you need new blood being pumped into the system all the time.
Well, what we're seeing is, I think, reflected in culture at large. It's the barbell effect. Mm. So you have great successes on the very high end. The mega galleries are succeeding. And there are about three or four Gagosian, Hauser and Wirth, Zwerner. A few others are in that category. And these are galleries where the sun never sets. They probably have a gallery somewhere in the world open at all times. And they have the capacity to do the art fairs, all the things expected of them, do the publications. The tiny galleries, which I have written about, the Bushwick galleries, can do okay too, because their overhead is very low, sometimes non-existent, sometimes it's out of someone's apartment. So they can put on shows that of their friends, of their artist friends, and they don't have to sell anything to make it work. Mm-hmm. I mean, except they get exhausted, but beyond that, they can keep going. It's really the middle galleries, which is the heart of the gallery system in New York, that are suffering, I think. Chelsea's been hollowed out. The galleries, the terrific galleries that succeeded there for years, have been priced out. Some have moved to the Upper East Side. Some have moved to the Lower East Side. Some have combined forces. Some have gone private. So you have galleries that were once public galleries or should now open by appointment only. And that trend will continue. The economics of the gallery scene, the gallery economics, are harder and harder to make it work with all the expectations.
Is there something to be said on this matter about the museum curators, like the curators of the Whitney, for instance, who are supposed to be going out to these sorts of galleries and finding new artists in order to put them in museum shows? Is there something to be said for, you know, how good of a job they're doing really seeking out the artists? Because that's what, you know, the idea being that you can kind of build up your reputation in the gallery system.
I mean, in the sports business, major teams support minor ones often as feeders. Do you think there should be some kind of partnering arrangement where big museums can, you know, open resources and even funding to sustain and develop new talent?
That'd be a great idea. I think the problem is also the collecting base doesn't have patience or the time to focus, to develop artists, to collect in mass, to collect in volume for an artist, help someone's career. There have been some great patrons and like Louis Dreyfus, for example, supporting so many artists in his life, quietly doing it, sometimes buying out whole shows. I don't think you're going to see that so much anymore. You see people swooping in at the art fairs, buying some things that other people seem to be talking about or putting on Instagram, and that's not really the way you develop talent.
Now, of course, at New Criterion, you are steadfast defenders of the permanent things and permanent qualities. How is the struggle going for the maintenance of posterity, really, which is what you're involved in? A terrible silence fell there.
Well, I don't know. The success of the Michelangelo, the success of the Delacroix, it shows that the public might be a little more clever than the museum curators give them credit for.
Amen. Yeah. It's the museum world and what they think is expected of them by their peers.
Yeah.
That's the worst influence. The
people have been
knows.
Voting with their pocketbooks. They show up for these big shows. And, you know, as you said, the Michelangelo had to be extended to accommodate.
People want series shows. And that's a drawing show. I mean, that's not even big paintings. That's a drawing show. And still, it was so well attended.
It broke records, I'm sure.
It shows you, museum curators, museum directors out there, please keep putting on good shows.
And it's a wonderful, hopeful note to end on. Now, Andy, if you'll open the door, you'll hear that the New Criterion and Encounter Books Christmas party is just beginning. You can see the circus entertainers. You can see the funny man with the beard and the big hat swilling from a bottle of absinthe. The dancers and the circus people and so on are all ready. So I think it's time for us to sign off here. James Pinero, Benjamin Riley, Andrew Shea, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dominic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to me, Dominic Green, casting the pod with them, the art critics of the New Criterion, on the Green Room Spectator USA's weekly Life and Arts podcast. You can find us, rate us, and even opinionate us wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also find us on iTunes under Spectator USA.
Till next week, thank you for listening. Goodbye.